This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, back in the think tank, Mike O'Neill here, and with the real Mike Russell that? In person. Welcome back.
They sent out a search party for me. Well, they found me.
I hope somebody got overtime for that.
I was out of fishing boat. They had a great time, let me tell you.
Yeah. Okay. We have a very special guest here, return guest, Jack August, historian.
Yes, nice to be here again. Good to see you guys.
Welcome to the show. Right. Hey, we're going to talk history, obviously, but let's clear up one thing, because I've heard this cited many, many times, never by historian, this business about history repeating itself.
Yeah, that's a cliche that anyone that is a historian disavows or would never use that phrase in any serious consideration of a historical event or a historical figure.
But we look to that because we call on our history and what we know in the past to draw similarities. And that's obviously where laymen like me say history is repeating itself. It just seems like, okay, because that's all I know. You know, I know what I've read. So then I see a similarity. I think, there it is. It's repeating itself.
Yeah, I understand that. But there is a distinction between the same event happening again and a similar event for the same reasons that may have caused it, whether it's poverty-inspired riot or something like that. But, you know, there are similarities in different civilizations and in human history, but history does not repeat itself per se.
And I think one of the diciest parts of that is when you try to use that as a means of prediction, because there are we take where we are now in presidential politics, and it's not difficult to see three or four distinct outcomes.
Sure.
And we could find an analogy for any one of those.
Correct.
But really no means of predicting that which one this is going to be.
Well, yeah. Oftentimes when people find out I'm a historian, first thing they say is, you don't look like a historian, number one.
What do historians look like?
I don't know, but not like me. And then secondly is they sometimes ask, well, could you predict what's going to happen? And I said, you know what? We interpret the past. People in my field look at the past, try to give some kind of order or coherence out of the chaos of the past, but we can't tell the future.
Hey, bud, you're not the only one. In the polling business, we get asked that all the time. It's not what we do. We take, at our very best, we take a snapshot of the present.
Well,
even that's flawed.
That's correct. And I know, and I've been talking with Bruce Merrill recently, and he's given me just an incredible insight into a field that he almost invented himself in behavioral politics and political behavior. And what a great guy he is, and how he pioneered and maybe influenced a generation of pollsters.
Mm-hmm. See, and for us in broadcasting, though, people say, do you remember when you said that? So historically, we don't remember anything. We walk out of the studio and hit purge. It's gone. I forgot everything I have already said, and trust me, it's for
sometimes
my own survival.
We're very thankful for that.
Yes, you are.
Put it all on YouTube, and that's one of the things that's happening now in our politics, when somebody gets up and said, well, you know, I've always been for this, and then you pull out six YouTube clips that say exactly the opposite. That's a new thing.
We're seeing a lot of that. The contradictions of running political campaigns and individuals, inherent contradictions.
And I don't think anyone's been safe from that. And that's a good point to bring up.
No one
has been safe from that.
You used to be able to say, well, you said this at such and such a time. That's not as powerful as showing you the clip of you making that statement with some vehemence, saying the exact opposite of what you're saying now.
I know. You're right. I think we're going to see that used quite often in the general election this time around.
Sure.
And, whether it's Senate, presidency, congressional races, and statewide races.
And how great is that? I think it is absolutely wonderful to let these politicians know you're not safe from this anymore. You can't just, no, I didn't say that. That does not work anymore.
Though, let me, in fairness, point out, I think that it's also said, and I think it's a good statement, you know, that consistency is the province of small minds, that somebody whose object in life is to be completely consistent, I don't think that's necessarily a virtue, but if you have shifted, you should be able to articulate why things have changed, why it's different, and why you've moved.
Well, you know what? In Arizona, we have a rather famous slash infamous former senator, Henry Fountain Ashurst, who was a U.S. senator from Arizona from 1912 from statehood to 1940. And he was known as the Dean of Inconsistency because he would shift roles on topics and issues almost daily. And he developed a kind of form of political power by being the Dean of Inconsistency in the Senate.
I guess so. It gives you flexibility if somebody's trying to buy that vote. Huh?
Inconsistency brings political power. Wow, that sums up a lot of our politics.
Well, there you go. You look at in a lot of votes where, you know, a lot of people are lined up yes and a lot of people are lined up no, predictably, the guy who sits on the fence is the one who can deal for the vote.
You're absolutely
right. You're into log rolling politics.
Well, you are. In fact, an example, my book on Senator DeConcini, if you pour into that one, 1993, the Clinton vote for the tax increase that kind of shaped the
real risky move on his part. Because he had Bill Clinton had run on, I'm going to cut your taxes.
Exactly. And so that was the key vote. And Bill Clinton took him on Air Force One and said, what can I do for you? Thank you for this vote. And he says, could you appoint Michael Hawkins to the Ninth Circuit? That was, and he did. And Hawkins served well. He's now in senior status. So that's just a little story. And also the Panama Canal. Bruce Merrill did a poll, and he told Dennis 85% of the people in Arizona are opposed to giving the Panama Canal back to the Panamanians. Dennis voted for giving it back. So he went against what Bruce Merrill told him the people felt.
As S.I. Hayakawa said at the time, it's ours. We stole it fair and square.
That's correct. Thank you, Theodore Roosevelt.
I have used that line over and over again. Yes.
Well, he was a linguist. Yes. And, you know, therefore, along with, I think, probably Daniel Patrick Moynihan, one of the most quotable senators we've ever had.
Oh, boy. Yes.
Okay. Parallels. We're in a situation that is really not. This is, I think, one thing's for sure. This is not going to be a normal election.
I agree with you. Just looking at what we have seen thus far, we are looking at a unique election. The only last time a kind of a businessman raced to the front out of nowhere was Wendell Willkie in 1940, and he didn't do well in the end. But that's as close as we get.
Well, we have Jack August here. And the reason why we have Jack August here, because he's a historian. And as he says, history doesn't repeat. Wait a second. Oh, wait. We want to draw some parallels, though. We want to see what
we
can look
back. I put that in for you, Mike.
Well, I appreciate that. We want to look back and see if we can find the consistency in the inconsistency. More on the Think Tank next.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, back in the think tank.
Sure.
With Jack August. We started to, the teaser was we're going to talk about the presidential election now. And not that we're going to say history is predictive, but there's some analogies that jump to mind. What's the first one? Now, we're in the middle of the process, so you get to change your mind after the fact. You're not in the prediction business. But if you were to take a presidential election that you would surmise thus far feels the most like the one we're in. What year comes to mind?
Well, two jump to mind, and I'm going to use 20th century instead of some of the 19th century elections. But I think the election of 1912 and the election of 1968, and that election. Let's start with the 68 and then move backwards.
Some of us still remember that one.
Yes, yes. And that's when George Wallace.
Third party
emerged. 1948, we had the Dixiecrats emerge as well. But I'm going to talk about 1968 and then 1912. But we had a splintering of the old Democratic Party of the South. Richard Nixon and
Lyndon Johnson signs the Civil Rights Act. 1965 says we've lost the South for a generation. He underestimated the length. He was right on the politics, but he underestimated. It's two full generations and counting.
That's correct. And what's interesting about that race is who becomes president in 1968? Richard Nixon. Defeats Hubert Humphrey, who emerges from that somewhat chaotic Democratic primary. And then George Wallace steps in and he wins five states. That might be that is the last time something like that happened, where a third party candidate won the electoral votes of five states, and of course that was the solid South, I think, all the way through Georgia, even Arkansas.
I think we point out too, a candidate, and most people don't know this and probably would be staggered by it.
Yes.
A third-party candidate comes in, gets 20% of the vote. That doesn't necessarily change a whole lot. But if they carry a few states, then this can change completely the way we elect our president, right?
Yes, exactly.
And your vote won't count.
Yeah, and we could mention 1992 also and Ross Perot, but he got in. He was leading the polls at one point, and then he dropped out. And then he got back in and said that the Republicans had infiltrated his daughter's wedding, and that was it. He went out. So he kind of flamed
weird.
Out.
It looked like there was some tinfoil hat stuff.
Yeah. That was exactly was. Right.
Yeah.
But like 1912 was a very interesting election with the Republican Party splintering. And what happened was that William Howard Taft was president. Historians have argued why Roosevelt came back and wanted to run against him and get the Republican nomination.
Roosevelt had already been president.
Had been president, served two terms, but just the most of McKinley's first term. So it's 1908, and he's kind of his appointed successor, William Howard Taft, gets into the office, and he controls the party apparatus, the conservative wing of the Republican Party. Of course, Theodore Roosevelt was known as a progressive, and if you look at some of his policies, he would have been a 20th century Democrat.
I think he'd be Bernie Sanders.
He'd be like a Bernie Sanders. That's a good analogy. But he steps in. They have a raucous convention. Roosevelt holds a rump convention, another convention, and the Progressive Party, and he gets Hiram Johnson, the progressive governor of California, to run with him. And in fact, he wins more. I think Taft won two states and got eight electoral votes. Roosevelt ended up getting 88 electoral votes, and then Woodrow Wilson, who was a kind of a compromise candidate on the 46th vote in the Democratic nomination process, the recently fired president of Princeton University and governor of New Jersey, falls into the presidency. And so we had a third-party candidate totally disrupted. And in Arizona, there was actually a fourth candidate in that election, Eugene V. Debs, the socialist. Mm-hmm. In fact, when we look at Arizona, we become a state in 1912, and you look at the canvas of that election, Wilson wins Arizona, Roosevelt finishes second, Debs finishes third, and the incumbent William Howard Taft finishes last in Arizona's first time it gets to vote for the presidency.
We became a state in the heyday of progressivism, which is why we have things that most of the eastern states don't have, like initiative, referendum, and all these things we vote on. Those are largely Western states that have them.
Direct democracy. They called it direct democracy.
Which was feared by the founding fathers.
Yes, and President Taft vetoed our first attempt at becoming a state because he did not he disavowed the idea of recalling judges by vote. Taft deserves a little run. I want to digress a little bit. He was a president, and he wasn't that bad. His former friend demonized him quite a bit. He also became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and then his final years in life, he was Dean of the Yale Law School. So he served in the three branches of government. Taft served as head of two of them, which is a really rather remarkable and distinguished career. So yeah, I want to
kind of remind you of Ernest McFarland, the Arizonan.
Yes, and he served as the Chief Justice of the Arizona Supreme Court after serving as first a senator, then as governor, and then trying to win back that Senate seat from Barry Goldwater twice. And but Goldwater was a force of nature, and McFarland had to settle, if you call it settling. But had he not been governor of Arizona, we wouldn't have made a change in the Arizona versus California Supreme Court case. And Mark Wilmer, who changed our argument to get Water, McFarland did that. He pulled the trigger on that because he was a good Water lawyer.
And if he'd never gotten beaten in the race for the United States Senate, that Texan would have never become president.
That's
Lyndon Johnson.
Lyndon Johnson. Yeah, you're right. So you never know. Every event is unique. And that series of events in the 50s and 60s are certainly unique events in America's political history.
So it's not. This is nothing new. Nothing new to see. Nothing new. How about that?
There's nothing new to see. Nothing new. And the unpredictability that we see before us, the presidential election coming up. I mean, we can maybe in the last segment discuss some of the scenarios we might see. Mm-hmm. But another one we might see, for example, happened in 1824, where four candidates again ran for president. Andrew Jackson won the popular vote. And the Electoral College, but he didn't have the 131. He had 99 electoral votes. He needed 131. He needed a majority of the electoral votes. And so he, John Quincy Adams, William Crawford, and Henry Clay. Henry Clay finished fourth. And so under Article 12 of the Constitution, the election goes to the House of Representatives. Jackson thought it was not a good thing You didn't go around politicking, and so he did nothing. What happened was the guy who finished fourth, Henry Clay, made the so-called corrupt bargain. It's called the Corrupt Bargain Campaign of 1824, and he threw his support to the guy who finished second, John Quincy Adams. And when Congress came back, Clay's support coalesced around Quincy Adams.
The thing about that that's staggering and comes to play, we'll go back to this point, is it results in an election of the president by the House of Representatives, and the guy they pick is not the guy who got the most votes, nor the most electoral votes.
That's the only time that's happened in history.
When we come back in the think tank, we'll talk about how that could happen this time.
Okay.
Uh-oh. Can it ever happen?
Might happen next.
Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, I teased the last segment with the thought that there's a scenario in this election how the person with neither the most votes nor the most electoral votes could become president elected by the House of Representatives. How's that happen?
Well, there's a lot of ways. Just like we explained in the 1824 election, none of the candidates wins a majority of the Electoral College, and then under Article 12, it goes to the House of Representatives.
And one vote, one state. It's not a vote of the whole House, which means that
correct. It's
a guaranteed Republican lock. There is no way they're not going to have a majority of states.
I agree with you. So looking if we look into the future, I agree with you, Dr. Mike, that if that scenario plays out, we will have a Republican president.
But there's one big thing that has to happen to make that possible, which is you need a third party candidate who carries some states.
That's correct.
Because if you have two candidates, somebody gets a majority. Unless you get a 269-269 tie, but that's another matter. And there are scenarios that are very plausible for the 269-269. You take the 10 states that are swing states.
Yes, that's right.
And you can do combinations to get you to a tie.
No, you're absolutely right. I think the one variable that's the 800-pound gorilla in the room is the Republican National Convention and Donald Trump's run and the delegate count. And again, I'm a historian. I can't foresee what's going to happen. I've already been surprised by some of the results in both parties.
We all have.
Yes. And so if he doesn't have a majority doesn't have the requisite number of delegates going into the convention, all hell's going to break loose. It's really hard to tell who the establishment Republican will be, whether it's Mitt Romney and his very interesting and provocative speech a few weeks back, which was roundly condemned by Trump and some others. And
predictably, the speech was a forthright attack on Donald Trump.
direct.
So
direct.
You know he's not going to not respond to that.
That's correct.
It's not in his DNA.
No. And then there's the Paul Ryan machinations that if anyone's even paying slight attention to social and television, talk show media, what's he doing? I still don't know what he's up to. And maybe
it's his playbook. This is exactly his playbook and how he became speaker. Just said, I don't want to, no, thanks. You know, I got a golf on Thursdays and, you know, I don't really want the responsibility. No, please, please, please. Maybe throw in this. Please, please. Okay, fine, I'll do it. And that's the thing. And he knows he gamed the system and became where he is today. And then if it is this type of thing, if he has presidential aspirations, he's going to pull the same trick and probably be begged to take it.
That is a scenario. I mean, that's realistic.
And if you want an example of somebody in recent political history who has negotiated from a position of strength, that was it.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, if I were to bet today, as interesting as Bernie Sanders has been and contributing thoughts, ideas, almost a latter day William Jennings Bryan, and adding some progressive ideas to the debate. Nevertheless, I think I foresee Hillary Clinton winning the Democratic nomination. And if, say, someone like Romney runs as a third party and he could win Utah, Idaho, perhaps even Arizona, given the LDS population, let's mm-hmm. be real here, and he wins X number of states, and that could end up with the House of Representatives situation.
Well, the LDS thing was underscored by the fact that Donald Trump didn't just lose Utah. He got trounced.
He got trounced in
Utah. Was it 80 to 15 or something like that? He was not a serious candidate in
Utah. There's some serious misgivings by some of the Republican establishment and the very conservative wing of the party about Donald Trump.
Well, there's a serious question about whether he's really a conservative, which is what they want.
Yes.
You know, he has played to anger, the conservative anger.
Sure.
Do you have any thoughts? Have we ever seen anything like this? I'm looking at both Trump and Sanders and saying, you know, their diagnosis of the situation is different. But they're both playing to segments of the population who are feeling that they've been shortchanged by the system.
I think you're right.
Have you ever had anything like that? I'm a multi-candidate, really.
Yes. I think
if you're talking about, you know, the 1824 or something, they split into four parties. In effect, you could look at this like we've got four parties right now. Bob Robb wrote a really interesting piece saying, you know, really we've got four parties now.
That's correct. And we can look at 1824 again. By 1820, there's no party. We have an uncontested presidential election, and James Monroe wins. There's only the Democratic Republicans. The Federalists have gone by the wayside. And so by 1824, you have just one party, the Democratic Republicans. All of them run under that banner, but then it fragments. We could be seeing something like that right now, even though the labels Republican and Democrat are still with us. What's Arizona's independent voter percentage? It's number one. It's leading.
It's almost 40%.
Almost 40% now. I think that's a strong indicator that these labels are, I'm not saying anachronistic, but they are less less compelling to, I think, the general population, and both Republicans and Democrats, I think.
I told you when we brought you on, you got a new job.
Yeah.
Tell us what you're doing.
Well, our current administration thought it might be good to have a historian of the Arizona and the Southwest nearby around. And so I agreed to become the historian and director of institutional advancement for the Arizona Capitol Museum, which is a symbol of state government, both past and present. Whenever you see the legislature reference, what picture do you see on TV or social media? A picture of the old territorial statewide state capitol. And it's a wonderful It's a wonderful building, a great and rich architectural history. So many interesting things have happened there. It is still, it's not only a museum, it's a wonderful environment to take kids. I think fourth graders we have coming in, I think 7th and 11th grade, you also get the Arizona history class. And but adults, people from around the world visit, and I think we had maybe 85,000 visitors last year. If I'm correct, and I think and it's just really a wonderful building, museum, and I urge everyone to come there.
Well, archive too. You got some interesting documents.
Well, yeah, we're part of the Secretary of State's office, and in our division is it's called Library, Archives, and Public Records, and it's a big and important agency of government that is. That it's interactive. If you want to go to the archives, which is located on 19th Avenue and Madison, just south of the Capitol, it's the Polly Rosenbaum Museum. It was just dedicated in 2009. It's a state-of-the-art archive museum. We should be proud of it. And we have all the governor's papers, the territorial governor's papers, a newspaper collection, Arizona Historical Newspaper Collection. You can read the Bisbee Daily News when Bisbee was – you had to go to campaign in Bisbee in 1912.
Because it was a big city.
It was a big city, and it was copper. It was power. It was Arizona's power 100 years ago. And so all those things, some wonderful letters collections, great water. As a historian, has written several books on water resource development. I've used their collections on water history many times, McFarland's papers, Governor Hunt's papers are fabulous. So everyone should just, even the general public should go and visit there.
Now, are those open stack? Can you just go down there and start browsing through that stuff, or is that by appointment? How's that work if
you want
to look at papers?
No, we have to treat those. Those are very rare and delicate documents. So we have archivists there, and we have finding aids, and you can you go and fill out a little form, and we bring them to you, and we make sure that they're preserved for everybody in Arizona.
And before we wrap up, Jack, just real quick, for those that are freaking out about this election, the world's coming unglued, the country's just coming unraveled, what would you suggest? What election would you suggest that they go back and study, that they go back and read about, maybe to calm themselves down a little bit and say, look, this isn't as bad as you think it is?
That's a good question. I think as early as our 1824 election, the Constitution worked. It could have Andrew Jackson was a really interesting, aggressive figure, and he went by the rule of the book, and he started running for president in 1828, which he won right away. He said, I got a guy kind of hosed, but they played by the rules, even though it was a corrupt bargain. And I think, look at that one. I think the election of 1892, where these ideas are out there, we have the populist. By the election of 1896, both major parties have incorporated the populist arguments into their platforms. We have a way of doing that in our democracy. And though there are some disparate ideologies and ideas, ultimately, in the past, we have somehow found a way to address some of the more extreme or controversial elements into the two parties.
We'll run over here a little bit. You've used this word, historical context now. What's a populist?
Populist, I'm thinking of the populist moment when we have farmers, the people that are disenfranchised by the rise of the Industrial Revolution, silver, but they wanted to use the Western mines for silver. You said Western miners, farmers, people in small cities, rural America. It was their last gasp and hope. And so they rallied around William Jennings Bryan for about four different elections. He's prominent. He even played a major role in the 1912 Democratic Party nomination and threw his support to Woodrow Wilson in the end.
So a populist is a guy who sees himself as having been disenfranchised by the system.
The system. He's an outsider running like as a maverick and getting these various societal elements, oftentimes that are on the outside of the moneyed classes.
Jack August, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. We appreciate your insight. We appreciate your stories. We love them all. Please come back as soon as you can as this all unfolds the way through the general election. Doc and I are going to wrap a big fat bow around this one when we come back on The Think Tank.
Thanks.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Jack's a good guy to have around. Let me tell you that. Jack August. What's his new title? You got the card over there.
Okay, the title. It's a mouthful. historian and institutional advancement, but basically he's in charge of the archives.
Yeah, that's so, that's a big gig.
Which is, you know, there's a distinct, there's a museum which people can walk through, and then there's the archives which have things like old governor's papers and things like that that generally speaking, serious historians will go through and review.
And it was encouraging to hear when he said this administration thought that it's neat to see that this administration thinks, hey, look, history is important to this state. It's a big deal. We need somebody like Jack to keep a guard of everything.
Well, the position has been there, but the cool thing was to bring a real historian.
That's right. Jack's the man. That's for sure. So I asked that question at the end because I really wanted to know what we could look at historically to take a deep breath. Relax. It's okay. The country is not unraveling. We have seen things like this before. We haven't seen this exactly before because, of course, you have different things in debt and deficit with the country and this and that. But I'm talking about what we've seen politically before. We've seen it before.
Well,
right.
One good example is we think we have a two-party system. Well, in fact, about every 20 years on average, we have a third-party candidacy.
Yeah.
Ross Perot was the last one. George Wallace in the 60s. Henry Wallace, 1948, we had Strom Thurmond, the Dixiecrats.
See, I can't talk about those guys because I didn't know those. But I can talk about some Ross Perot. And I can talk about some Donald Trump, by the way.
They're just
as entertaining. Both of them are very entertaining.
And right now, there are discussions amongst those in the establishment wing of the Republican Party who are some of them are thinking they cannot live with Donald Trump. And they're talking about running an establishment Republican as a third party. Now, they are doing so almost – it's almost a suicide effort because if that happens, well, if unless that person carries a bunch of states – it throws the election to Hillary Clinton, but there is a scenario whereby that person carries a few states, and no candidate is given
the electoral college
majority. Thank you. And then it goes to the House. And if it goes to the House, even if this person only gets 15% of the total vote, the establishment Republican will be selected by the House to be president. Because that's who controls the House.
And what that says, and I don't care what the DNC or RNC, I really don't care at this point. And Doc, I'll remove my political affiliation just for this quick exercise, and I hope you would do the same. Because the what I'm seeing, and I'm writing a piece on this right now for KTAR, I see that if the RNC were to put their candidate up there, that they truly, truly do not get it. And when I say it, I'm talking about the will of the people. And I'm going to go back further than Donald Trump, okay? Because let's understand. We knew who Ronald Reagan was. We knew who H.W. Bush was. We knew who Bill Clinton was. They had voting records. They had records. They had resumes. They had all of this. Then the country was fed up with this nonsense. They were just we knew who W was. Fed up with this nonsense. We're going to elect somebody we don't know darn near anything about. Relatively, we knew nothing about Barack Obama. We elected him twice. Mm-hmm. The country is tired of the same old, same old. Now that Barack Obama has run his second term and we have the two batches coming up again, here's a Bernie Sanders who's just so far out of anything we've seen from a serious presidential candidate in a very long time, and Donald Trump, who's just out of nowhere. I'm seeing and I'm feeling this country is just, we're just tired of the same old DC nonsense.
But I think the point of Jack would make is, hey, we've seen stuff like this before.
Sure.
That normalcy, we think normalcy is the two parties. Now we've got some other things going on because the two parties don't fully represent what people feel.
Exactly.
Now the danger is that if you don't have somebody with a record, they can become, if they run their campaign artfully enough, they can become a Rorschach test for what you want to believe.
That's what Barack Obama was, and he had to have been because we knew nothing.
Certainly
about
the first time. I don't think you can make that case.
After he'd been president
for 4 years, you had a pretty good idea what you're getting. And you, by the way, the result in 2012 was a virtual replication of 2008.
Agreed.
So, but yeah, in 2008, it's somebody with a relatively thin resume and not a whole lot of track record. a la a Donald Trump, mm-hmm. you know,
right.
And frankly, to the extent that he has a public record on a large number of the issues, his public record is exactly the opposite of what his own candidacy is saying right now.
Okay, well, that's fine. As is Hillary's. I mean, let's be real. When she, especially when we talked about YouTube in the first segment,
oh, God.
When she says simply, "Where was Bernie Sanders when I was pitching for universal health care back when my husband was president?" Yeah. And it's all these videos of him standing right behind her. Yeah. Literally, Hills.
Oh, okay. Right. She's made bad statements, but no. She has a very consistent and a very well-established...
With gay rights? Absolutely not. No way. No.
The whole country... I'm not saying she never changed her mind. The whole country changed its mind. You know, in 1992, when Clinton put in Don't Ask, Don't Tell...
Uh-huh.
It was considered an abandonment by the gay rights movement. They were peeved. They expected more. But in point of fact, it was a point of political pragmatism. He looked at it and said, "This is the best I can do."
Okay.
And you know what? Had he done any, and he took
incredible.
No, but he took incredible flack for that. And she was with him. And when Obama said he evolved, you know. He didn't evolve.
Well,
he was already
okay,
there.
But, I'm not
but he
about
recognized.
Evolution.
They all recognized the art of the possible.
I'm not talking about an evolution. When you're talking about somebody saying one thing, you're talking about Donald Trump. So we got to look at the other side of the ball. Let's be fair. So if you're going to talk about Donald Trump saying one thing and then come back and saying the other, we've seen them all. We've seen the YouTube clips, countless of them, just did over and over again. But on specifically, and because we started this down this road of gay rights, I will say that her track record on video. Of her saying marriage is between a man and woman, not that's the best we could do when Bill was president. I'm talking about when she was Senator
and
Clinton.
You will put in that.
And then she says, she said, "I have never said that." It goes back to what we were talking about earlier. That's what I'm saying.
She did
both
say
sides
that. Along the entire political establishment moved on that issue because the people moved.
Because, both sides of the ball.
Because the gay rights movement did an incredible thing, and I think a lot of it had to do with outing people and all. And they moved the public, and then the politicians fell out.
Can we just admit
that
both sides of the ball are saying one thing when they've said another in the past?
But I won't say that
it's
not to the same extent. And Donald Trump, I think, has been in the extreme case. Anyway, if you want to see past archives, they're all on MikeO'Neill.org. The occasional Twitter, Michael J. O'Neill. You got one? You got a Twitter feed?
Yeah, Mike Russell, KTAR. It's easy breezy, just like that. That's me right here. Or you can just email me at Mike KTAR.
The big one, you can see whole shows, MikeO'Neill.org. Click on the radio button. They're all there.
You can hear whole shows. You can't see them.
Did I say see?
Yeah. This isn't TV,
you
Doc.
Can visualize. Our words are so vivid.
Our pictures
you can
are on KTAR.com. You can just picture us talking. It's just so much fun. Thanks for spending some time with us right here on The Think Tank, KTAR News.